This is the first day of unleavened bread, which is the first of the holy days for 2008. We all are aware of that. First one. And that is really great. We have been hearing some excellent sermons on getting the leaven out and getting spiritual leaven out and so forth. And I thought today that since we've had very good sermons about that so far, that I wouldn't try to speak about that in the same way that these men have been talking about it. We commonly cover that on the first day of unleavened bread, but we can also cover the time that the children of Israel went out of Egypt. And I chose not to do that today either, for that goes, because that was the beginning of all of this. The children of Israel went out of Egypt on this day, and it was to be a memorial forever. I could turn just to a verse to show that. I guess I didn't show it, but Exodus 13, and I believe verse 3 says, Moses spoke to the people, and they said, remember this day, and that's this day, the 15th day of Nisan, which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leaven shall be eaten. And on this day you are going out in the month of Abib. We call it Nisan, or a different language, whatever language. It's the same month. And it shall be when the Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites, all these other ites that he swore to your fathers to give, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. I just thought I would mention that. Ought to keep this service in this month. Again, there are so many things I could talk about on that. However, I would like to take today just a little different situation on that. I want to talk about some of the events, particularly around the timing of the one biggest sacrifice of all, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And on this first day of unleavened bread, I think it might be appropriate just to do that. The Apostle Peter told us we need to be reminded of these things all the time. I'll probably turn to that scripture a little later, but for the time being, I would prefer to talk about the fact that we also come out of slavery as a starter, and maybe it'd be good for us to see how we have been taught. I was taught from the time I was a tiny child that Christ died on Friday and was resurrected on Sunday morning. And I had that so deeply stuck in my mind that I believed it. You know, as a little child, all of the elders taught me that, and my parents taught me that, and I believed it for a time. But there, somehow I could never fit 3 days and three nights in that. Just didn't work. And even as a child, I couldn't do that. So always had that question in mind, and I guess I had that for all the way up till I got over 30 years of age, when I really got serious about this matter of studying this to find out about this 3 days and three night business. I want to turn to Romans 6 and verse 16 at the start. Romans 6 and verse 16. Here we read of our coming out of slavery, if you please. Here Romans 6 and verse 16 says, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? Well, I didn't consider my teachings as being unrighteous as far as that goes, but they weren't right, were they? Then they were unrighteous. Is that simple? I lived in it. I believed it. And verse 16 and verse 17. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, and I certainly was for all of those young years, you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And that wasn't easy either. I had a little trouble kind of understanding a lot of these things before I could really resolve to steel myself to obey those things. But what happens when we do? Verse 18. And having been set free from sin, how on earth could we do that? We did that by the awesome sacrifice that we're commemorating. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ. It's the only possible way that we could be freed from sin. And we are. Yet you were set free from sin and became the slaves of righteousness. Now we got a new master, didn't we? And I'm so happy about that, to be under a rightful master, Jesus Christ, who's going to come and rule for 1,000 years, and that's part of the later event of this. First, I thought it'd be good just to show that the holy days actually picture God's plan for mankind all the way down the line. The first day of unleavened bread is the one that we're observing now. And the first day of unleavened bread then actually pictures God's calling us out of that mess to make us his slaves ultimately if we will yield to him. And he purchases us with his shed blood, or his very life, if you please. And he has done that. He gave his life in my stead. Now, that was a little bit hard for me to swallow back in my pretty righteous days, you know. After all, I was a pretty good guy. If you didn't want to believe it, just ask me. Back in those days, I had to come off that and come to the realization that it wasn't so, that I could have nothing except for the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And I had to come down to that level and come to that realization. Now, that's the level of repentance, then, that is really pictured by the first day of unleavened bread. I want to run through those just very briefly. What did I do? Bring the wrong notes here or something? No, I don't think so. The last day of unleavened bread, then, what does that picture? Well, it pictures Israel going through the Red Sea. And going through the Red Sea, they symbolized baptism. I hope you realize that. 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. I might just turn to that briefly. 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. Some of these verses I still remember anyhow. Chapter 10 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. Now, they passed through the sea on what we customarily always point out was the last day of unleavened bread, and were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. So even the Apostle Paul said that they were baptized in going through the sea. That is a representation of baptism then. And so that means that the last day of unleavened bread pictures our completely coming out by being baptized and then submitting ourselves completely to that new slave owner, if I may put it that way, to God as our Savior and being. The next holy day then will be Pentecost. And that pictures the time when the Holy Spirit was poured out upon all mankind. And it also pictures a new begettal, if you please. It pictures that, a begettal of God's Holy Spirit. Now, before we can be born in the Spirit, as Jesus told Nicodemus, he had to be born again, we have to be begotten, obviously. And then Pentecost is the time when we are begotten as actual children of God. 1 John, the 3rd chapter. I think I'll turn to that just briefly first. 1 John, the 1st chapter. Pardon me, the 3rd chapter. 1 John 3 and verse 1, it says, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called," what? "Children of God." We should be called children of God. "Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him." No, they throw him out of the schools and out of the buildings and out of everything nowadays. It's unthinkable. But verse 2, he says, "Beloved, now," right now, "now we are children of God." He was speaking to those that were baptized members. "We are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." Now, when we're not even born yet, we don't really know much about that. How much do I know about standing here today when my mother was still carrying me? I didn't know much, I'll assure you. We're unborn children of God, but we are destined to be born into God's family. The alternative is unthinkable. We don't even want to talk about that. And I think we all know and realize that. But we are to become children of God. That's pictured by the begettal at Pentecost. Now, the next one is the Feast of Trumpets. And that pictures the next thing that is to happen in God's plan for all of us. And the next thing to happen will be the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and the first resurrection, that is termed. Christ was the first of the first fruits, but the first fruits then will be resurrected, and it's called the first resurrection. And that will happen at that's what the Feast of Trumpets pictures. Christ returning to this earth and taking over as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, the next one is the Day of Atonement, and that is pictures exactly what it says, at one with God. Mankind at one with God, finally becoming at one with God altogether. What a marvelous thing that is pictured on that Day of Atonement, the 10th day of the 7th month. Then the next one is the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'm just kind of running across these just to show that that's the whole plan that God has for mankind. Then the Feast of Tabernacles pictures Christ's reign for 1,000 years right here on this earth, when everything will be under his laws and they'll be kept. Israel will do what they never did. They'll go back to their nations and be in their places, and all of the nations of the world will come to them because of their wisdom under Jesus Christ, and they're coming to the King. All different attitude than everybody else in the world then, when Christ reigns over all of the nations, and that will be for 1,000 years. And then the last great day, of course, is the great one, when I'll turn to John, the 5th chapter on that one. Let's turn to John 5 and verse 28. John chapter 5 and verse 28. And here it tells us that in red letters here in my Bible, Jesus speaking this, he says, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in the which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who have done good into the resurrection of life." That's quite obviously the first resurrection. And that will be 1,000 years before the second one comes. And those who have done evil in the resurrection of condemnation, but before they're all condemned, you see, they'll have to be given an opportunity to know the truth of the matter. God's going to place his Holy Spirit upon them. Then if they reject, then they're gone forever. And rightly so. I think we all know and realize he's not going to have any rebels in his kingdom. We're either all going to learn to fully obey him, and rightly so and righteously so, happily, righteously so, which we can, we have to grow into that. That's the process of the trials and temptations that we have now in this life. So we need to grow into all of that, and that's pictured by the last great day, when then all will be peace and harmony in God's kingdom. What a marvelous picture that'll be when it's finally completed. Well, today, however, I said, I'm going to remind you, I'll turn to 1 Peter to show you again why we do this. Most of you know some of these things that I'm going to cover here and the things I have already. You've heard them for many, many, many years. For me, it's over 50 years. But every time, every year on those anniversary dates, I do need to be reminded. I need to be reminded of these things. And so I'm going to remind you of some of these events today. That's the pattern. The Apostle Peter, Second Peter, chapter 1 and verse 12. It says, for this reason, the Apostle Peter says, 2 Peter 1 and verse 12, for this reason I will not be negligent to remind you always of these things, though you know and are established in the present truth, yet I think it is right, as long as I am in this tent, as long as he lives, he was still alive at this time, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing this, that shortly I must be put off my tent, as God has shown me. Moreover, I will be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things. And so here it is, right there. He left that as a writing for all of us, for all eternity, in God's words. Those were marvelous words that he put. In order to start off with all of this, to show some of these things, I want to turn to the 12th chapter of Matthew and go into the matter that people wanted to know about this Messiah and all of the things about this. And so how did they go at it? Just about as carnal as I would have back in those days when I was still looking for all of these things. In Matthew 12 and verse 38, then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, teacher, we want to see a sign. I want to see a sign of the Messiahship and all of these things. But he answered and said unto them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except one. One sign. No sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, it says in my New King James here, I think it says the whale in your Old King James, if I remember it correctly, but so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. And I wrestled over that. I wrestled those verses for a long time. How could that be from Friday till Sunday morning? Just didn't fit. And I couldn't make it fit. And I'd go to theologians and ask them, and they would wrangle around this and make Friday, Saturday, and Sunday 3 days, but it surely didn't make up 72 hours. Just didn't do it. So if we go back to Jonah and look at the sign of Jonah, you can turn back to the little book of Jonah. You know, it's right after Obadiah, so you can find that real easy, can't you? I shouldn't joke about that because maybe I can't find it. Jonah, right after the book of Obadiah and just before Micah in the Old Testament. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. So you can rattle them off too, I think, probably. But Jonah chapter 1 and verse 17. Let's see this fish, this big fish. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish. What did that say? A whale? No. It's a. How could a person live in any kind of a fish, irrespective of what may it be, in the gastric acids of the stomach of a fish? Why, they'd be digested before 3 days was up. There's no doubt about that. Crazy. Couldn't possibly be. But this was so. When it says that God prepared, hey, now this was some fish that God prepared. He could live there for 3 days and three nights, all right, and mull over his disobedience for not doing what God said, and he was ready to obey when he comes out of this. But the great fish swallowed Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And you can go to all of the commentaries. I have lots of them. And they nearly all picture, if you turn to that particular passage, they say it had to be fully 72 hours. Full 72 hours. One sign that would designate the sign of the Messiah. That's what Jesus said. Now, since that's the case, why, maybe we ought to kind of look at that one sign a little bit. First off, what is the prophetic setting? Go to Daniel, the chapter. Daniel. I want to go to the book of Daniel this time. And want to point out a prophecy about these things. It'll help us get some of the setting of it all. Daniel 9, and I think I want verse 24, 25, first off. Daniel 9, verses 24 and 25. Where it says 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins. Now, when did sins end? When Jesus Christ died. That's the only possible way they could end. To make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness. It was never available until Christ paid that major penalty. To seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Holy One, the Most Holy. Now that's interesting, because that Most Holy is probably referring to the Most Holy place in the temple, where the high priest went in only once a year on the Day of Atonement. But that's just a sidelight. Knowing, therefore, and understand. Now, let's see this. Knowing and understanding that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince. Now, that's a pretty important verse there. From the time that the command went forth to restore and build Jerusalem, when did that go forth? Well, we can go over to Ezra and find out. If we go to Ezra and look at Ezra, the 7th chapter, it tells us about that command that went forth. Ezra chapter 7 and verse 7, I think. Some of the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the singers and the gatekeepers and the Nethinim, came up to Jerusalem in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes. And Ezra came in Jerusalem in the 5th month, which is in the 7th year of the king. Now, by the time of Artaxerxes and in Persia at that stage, we know that history is pretty accurate. After about 1000 BC, the events in history were delineated quite accurately. And so we know what that 7th year of Artaxerxes was. It happened to be 457 BC. And that can be searched out in history. I'm not going through the histories to point that out to you, because I don't have time to back up for all of those things if I ever get through this. But we'll see if we can squeeze it in. And go to see the fact that this was the prophecy that Jonah was talking about that Daniel was talking about in Daniel, the 9th chapter, in verse 24 and 25. That's a very important prophecy. Now, prophecy, as is numbered by a day, is a year. Now, all of you old heads know that long in time, and there's two places where it's shown that, and I'm going to turn to just one of them. Numbers, the 14th chapter. Numbers chapter 14. Oh, if I can catch it here, maybe I can find it eventually. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 34, I believe is what I want. That kind of comes to memory again. According to the number of the days in which you spied out, let's read verse 33 first. Your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. God was fed up with these people out there because they disobeyed, and then the spies went out and they came back with a bad report. But he says, according to the number of the days that you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt or your iniquity, 1 year, namely 40 years, you shall count, know my rejection. So he says a day for a year, that's prophetic. So when we go to Daniel and read his prophecy, that there'll be, verse 25, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Well, 7 and 62 would be 69. Even I can figure that out. Even if I couldn't figure out how many we had for the Passover, we had 58, not 68, as it turned out. We had, I said 68, and we had 58, actually, because there was 10 in one container and 12 in the other, and 22 off of 80 would be 58. Let's see. But the street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. I looked at Mike like that because he and I were the ones that did that. And so, who was it? President Truman says, the buck stops here. That's the way it is. I'm the one that's responsible for making the mistake. Verse 26, after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. Well, I'll get to that a little bit later, but first off, this command went forth from Artaxerxes 457 B.C. Now, if there is 69 weeks until the Messiah comes, now 69 weeks of days figures out to be 483 days. You can calculate them out. A day for a week for 69. 7 times 69, simple. And that's how many days would be 483. Well, now 483 would be to when the Messiah comes. Now, when the Messiah comes for his ministry, when did he start his ministry? When he was about 30 years of age. We'll get to that verse in a moment. But if you take 457 from 483, you get 26. So 26 A.D. Wait a minute. He came in 27 A.D. Well, no problem. There was no year zero. So it should have been added 27 in the first place. You have to put the Z's. See, they went from B.C. 1 to A.D. 1. And skip the fact that there was supposed to be a zero in there. And so you have to add a year whenever you make those calculations, so it comes out 27 A.D., and that fits. Now, it's very interesting because let's go to Daniel 9 here and verse 27, I believe is what I want now. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. Now, 1 week is 7 days. We're in prophecy here. So, 7 days. But in the middle of the week. Well, what day is the middle of the week? Wednesday. Or the fourth day of the week. There are 3 days before and 3 days after. Fourth day of the week, very simple. The middle of the week is Wednesday. Now, there are two things here that are vitally important if we catch them. One was the middle of the week was the prophecies that this time was to be. And the other important thing is that that was the preparation day and the day that Jesus Christ was offered as the supreme sacrifice above all. He gave his life. Those are two very important things. Now, one of the things that actually was fulfilled when he died was the completion or the fulfilling of the law, the marriage covenant that he made with Israel. A lot of people never ever thought about that, but he was married, and you hear all of these crazy things about him having children with other women and all that kind of, he was always faithful to his marriage. He never failed. Never. And he never sinned. And so up until the time that he died, he was still married in that old covenant. Then he was free of that marriage. He fulfilled the law. Matthew 5:17, I believe it is. And just another little highlight, sidelight along the way. But he fulfilled that marriage covenant. Now he's free to marry again, of course. Just as when my wife died in 1996, why, I said, hey, I'm old enough, I don't ever want to get married again. But I ate my own cooking for a couple of years, and I decided that wasn't the way to go. My wife said, yeah, you just married me for my cooking. But I got a lot more than just a good cook, I'll assure you. And I do appreciate my wife. I'm sorry she's not here. She said this is the first holy day she ever missed. That hurts her, I'll assure you. She really wanted to be with you today, I'll assure you, brethren. Back to Daniel 9, verse 27. He says, I'll read the verse. It says, then he shall confirm a covenant for many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, now in the middle of the week is, if it's a prophetic week, there are 7 years. And the middle of that would be 3.5 days, obviously. Divide 7 by 2, and it's 3.5. And so he's 3.5 years he was to be cut off. Let's see, at the end of, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. All the offerings that were given, all of the blood sacrifices and everything, were all fulfilled in Jesus Christ shedding his blood as the one sacrifice to fulfill them all. And let's see. And on the wing of an abomination shall it be who makes desolate even until the consummation, which is determined. I don't need that part. We wanted only the first part of that verse anyway. The fact that he was cut off in the middle of the week. Now there are some facts in the New Testament that help us to see that once we get our feet on the ground just a little bit from prophecy right off of the bat to see how some of these things actually are to work out. Let's go to Leviticus, the 3rd chapter, just to show that when Jesus Christ started his ministry, how old was he? Luke, I can't even say that. Sorry about that. Luke chapter 3 and verse 23. Now, Jesus himself began his ministry Very clear statement here, no problem. At about 30 years of age. So he was about 30 years of age, 27 A.D. Well, he was born at 4 B.C. and no year zero in there, see? And so he was 30 years of age, 27 A.D., when he began his ministry. And I don't need to read the rest of that verse. I think all of you have been through the heritage of Jesus in many times before, but I wanted that part to show that he was 23 when he began his ministry, 23 years of age, and then he must have been about 33 and a half when he was crucified, because he was had 3 and a half. He was cut off in the middle of the week. The middle of the week is 3 and a half years. And he was cut off in 3 and a half years. He was about 33 and a half when he was crucified. And that had to be then Passover on 31 A.D., if you calculate it out. And ironically, I don't know, I used to have a copy of the calendar, the Hebrew calendar, and the computations of it. One time I stuck 31 A.D. in there just to see what day that would Passover would fall on. And what day do you suppose it fell on? Well, you all know it was on Wednesday. Obviously, the middle of the week, and it falls just that way. Right even on the computer calendar program that I had back then. And it fell that way right there, just as clear as could be. So you see, when you put these things together properly, pieces all fit. Everything begins to come together. Now things were beginning to make sense to me when I got studying some of this. Let's go to Mark, the 15th chapter now. I got a long ways to go here yet, so I need to ramble. I don't want to run away from you with this stuff, but I also have to go through or else I won't make it. I won't get through it all. Mark, the 15th chapter in verse 33 to 37. Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. I don't think we can even imagine that. You know, suddenly it was black on the preparation day for the Seder meal for all of the Jews in Jerusalem, and suddenly it turns black. Kind of hard to prepare for the killing the lamb and doing all of that when it was black, you know. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, Eloi, lama sabachthani?" I can't pronounce the Greek or the Hebrew right, but in it, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of those that stood by, when they heard this, said, "Well, he's calling for Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge full of sour wine, put it to his lips and offered it to him and to drink, saying, "Let us alone and see if Elijah will come." And Jesus cried out with a loud voice and breathed his last. Oh, there are a lot of little things missing in there yet. And so we need to go some other verses to pick up some of these details. Here was 3 hours of darkness on that preparation day. And let's go to Luke, the 23rd chapter now. Luke, the 23rd chapter. Pick up this same event that was talked about here. And verse 44, starting in verse 44, where it says, "Now it was about the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour, then the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was torn in two. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last." Now, it's interesting. Still something missing here. How did he die? Doesn't tell us there. Just said he breathed his last. So, now let's go to John version of this. John, the 19th chapter. I wanted to cite this one first. John 19 and verse 31. John 19 and verse 31, where it says, "Therefore, because it was the preparation day." Preparation day for what? Well, for the high day, the first day of unleavened bread. That's what it was the preparation day for. That the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath. And that's a custom of the Jews. I think any of you that have ever been around any of the Jews know that. Anytime someone dies, they bury them that day. They don't fool around and have wakes and all this kind of stuff. They just bury them right on that same day. For that Sabbath was a high day. Oh, that helps us some. That Sabbath was a high day. And the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. And the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and the other who was crucified with him. When they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead. You know, not a bone of his broken body was broken, it tells us in Psalms. How did he die? And they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side. I want you to look at that word pierce. It's past tense. In other words, it had been done already. Actually, it'd be a lot better to understand if we got it the way it ought to be translated. One of the soldiers had pierced his side. That would make a lot more sense. Had pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. Now, that's the way it ought to be translated. How do I know? Because in Matthew 27, there's a verse missing in the normal Bibles. But I brought the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, and I want to turn to that, Matthew 27, and I want start about verse 47 or somewhere along in there to get the proper setting here. Yeah, you see, verse 45 says that he cried, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And verse 48 says, "And one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave it for him to drink." Let's see. But the others said, "Wait, let's see whether Elijah will come to save him." And immediately, another took a spear, pierced his side, and out came water and blood. Now, you didn't read that in yours, did you? If you had the Revised Standard, you had to go to the margin like I did. Because they say right in the margin in the Revised Standard Version, and incidentally, Moffat puts it right in the context like it should be. And there are very few translations of the Bible that have that verse properly put in where it belongs, because it is in some of the major, oldest manuscripts. So it ought to be there. And at least the Revised Standard Version, they put it in the footnote in it, and I read it that way. I didn't read it like it really is here, where it said, "Wait, let's see if Elijah will come and give him." And Jesus called again with a loud voice and yield up the spirit. See, that verse now tells us how he died. A Roman soldier ran a spear right up through him, and out came water and blood. Now, it's a little gory when you think of it in that light, but I don't think they were that kind to him that they let him run out the bathroom every time he had to go or something like that. So his bladder was obviously very full, and the soldier went right up through his abdomen and right up through the division between the heart and the stomach there, right up into the heart cavity, and out came all the blood, just all poured out, and he died right there. That's how he died. So when the soldier came to break the legs, he was already dead, and no question about that part. This is the part that, it's a shame that we don't have the proper translations to cover all of this. I did want one more thing to point out about all of this. I want to turn to Matthew, the 28th chapter this time, and verse 1. Now it says, after the Sabbath. But it doesn't translate it correctly. Sorry to say about that. After the Sabbaths, plural, it should say, because there are two here. Now, after the Sabbaths, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to the tomb, see the tomb. And I studied many, many commentaries and so forth, and the only place I found this in any of the writings that I have, I think Fenton does put it that way, and I don't have a Fenton Bible, but I had to dig out this thing, and I dug it out, and lo and behold, it gives me the proper translation of that word. This, incidentally, is an interlinear Bible, both the Hebrew and Aramaic, and in the Old Testament, and interlinear, word by word, and in the Greek, word by word, of all of the Greek. So, in chapter 28 of Matthew, and verse 1, we have the spelling of this word. And the spelling, if you know enough of the Greek, why, I could spell it for you as far as that goes. I don't know much about Greek, but at least I could spell the word Sabbath. It's sigma, alpha, beta, beta, alpha, tau, omicron, nu is the spelling of the Sabbath when it's singular. But it's not spelled that way here. Here it is spelled, and I can read it off for you. It's spelled sigma, alpha, beta, beta, alpha, tau, omega, nu. That makes it plural. It is plural. And they have it here in this interlinear. All the rest of them spell it correctly, too, but they translate it wrong. But here he has it translated correctly. He says, here it says, now the Sabbaths, plural. He just translates it right out. It's a plural word. He translates it at the Sabbaths. So there were two that week, obviously. And there were two Sabbaths. And if we catch all of that, then we begin to get the picture of what this is all about. Back to Mark 15 and verse 47. I have to go ahead to Mark since I'm in Matthew, but Mark 15 and verse 47, I wanted to read this because it says, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, observed where he was laid. Well, where was he laid? At the very end of the preparation day for the high day, Wednesday of that week, right before sundown. They rolled the stone together right at the end of the preparation day, which is the beginning of the high day Sabbath. Everything was closed up after that. And there they were, right there, watching where he was laid. So they didn't do anything after that except observe the Sabbath, the high day Sabbath, that is. And if we go on then to chapter 16 and verse 1, it says, now, when the Sabbath was passed, which Sabbath are we talking about here? Well, just following it right on in context is obviously the high day Sabbath, Nisan 15. When the Nisan 15 was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, mother of James and so forth, bought spices that they might come and anoint him. Obviously, they couldn't buy him that night because it was right before the Sabbath. So it had to be the next day after the high day, which was Friday. Now, the Protestant translations, they don't do it that way either for you, I'll assure you. They don't take it like it should be. So let's get a little more help here. Let's go to Luke, the 23rd chapter. And I didn't quite make it by 4 o'clock, did I? Matthew, let's go to Luke 23. Luke 23, and we get this put on ice here. This is so beautiful. Luke 23 and verse 55. Here we read, the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb where the body was laid. Verse 56. Then they returned and prepared spices. Couldn't have been right after that, because that was the Sabbath that came after this. Fragrant oils. And they rested on the Sabbath. They rested on the high day? Ah, not so. Look at this Sabbath. They rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Which commandment, which Sabbath is the commandment? Well, obviously, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the commandment, if you please. That's the Sabbath of the commandment. Now, after they got the spices and prepared all of them, they rested on the weekly Sabbath then, according to the commandment. And if you catch that, that ties this down solid. You don't need to ever worry about the fact that there weren't two Sabbath days within that week. It makes it so clear right there. The Sabbath according to the commandment, and then chapter 24 and verse 1 says, now in the first day of the week, very early in the morning, and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spices whom they had prepared. So now it was after the weekly Sabbath, or the first day of the week, they came, and very early in the morning, while it was still dark, John says, no, it wasn't Sunday in daylight or daytime at all. He was already risen, and he'd been risen. So the 3 days and three nights now suddenly make sense, clearly. Without any question of a doubt. The 3 days and three nights was the first day of the week. Now it all fits together perfectly when we put those pieces together. I'm going to quit here because time is up. But it says, he died, Wednesday, the fourth day of the week, and he was in the tomb. 3 days and three nights, that's what the sign told us, the sign of Jonah. Wednesday night, then, was one night of the 3 days and three nights. Thursday was the first one of the days. One day. Friday, Thursday night then was the second night. Thursday morning, Thursday during the day was the first day, and Thursday night was the second night, because Wednesday night was when he was put in the tomb. And Friday was the second day, and then Friday night was the third night. Now there's the 3 days and the three nights. No Sunday morning in this at all. And no first day of the week in that at all. But there's the 3 days and three nights. So at the end of the Sabbath day, we call it Friday night was the beginning of the Sabbath. Actually, the day starts at sundown. But then Saturday during the day was the third day. There's the 3 days and the three nights. And that's when he was resurrected. Because the tomb was already open and the clothes were all set there in order and everything. But very early in the morning, it doesn't say, could have been any time after midnight, because that's morning. And that's when they came and he was already resurrected. Well, sure he was. The sign was that he would be there 3 days and three nights, and he was. So he was resurrected at the end of the Sabbath day, that is the Sabbath according to the commandments that week. And he had 3 days and three nights. Now, if we got all of these things, then we never have to worry about that time. But we do have to be reminded of these things year by year. So I wanted to go across that just as a reminder to all of you. We have 6 more days of unleavened bread for us to get all the spiritual leaven out, as well as having the physical leaven out. That should have been out last night before sundown, and was in our stead, I'm quite sure. But I wanted to go across that to show you the events that sometimes cause a lot of problems to people, did to me for a long time until I finally believed all of the events and went to the various scriptures myself and got them all figured out. With that, we'll end the service today, and the very best to you all on the first day of unleavened bread.